Hello, welcome to the House of Comments. This is a regular podcast, although we're on a hiatus at the moment. We talk about politics. But I have decided to resurrect it for a one-off episode. I'm actually in the middle of a load of stuff myself at the moment, moving house, etc. But I could not let this week pass without a special episode, because I think one of the most seismic things of recent years has happened in politics this week, and it's that Conservative MP Douglas Carswell has decided to defect to UKIP. But perhaps even more significant than that, what he's decided to do is not just defect, which, you know, we've seen many defections over the years. He's actually decided to stand down and force a by-election in his constituency in Clacton. And even more surprisingly, it appears that there's an overwhelming likelihood that he's going to win as the UKIP candidate. Now, joining me to discuss this today and the potential ramifications of it are Mark Wallace from Conservative Home. Hi, Mark.
Hi.
Thanks for joining me. Can you just give me your initial thoughts on this? You know, what were your first thoughts when you heard the news the other day? Were you surprised by this? Were you expecting it?
To say I was surprised is an understatement, to be honest with you. I got a message firstly in the morning on the Thursday from a UKIP press officer who said, just so you know, we've got something on at 11 o'clock. It's going to be a big announcement from Nigel. Do you want to come along? And so I kind of said, well, what's it going to be? Well, what's it about? And he said, I don't know. He won't tell us. He won't tell anyone else in the office. He won't tell any of the other MEPs. So I think this is why I thought you might be interested. So I kind of toddled along. Even sitting in the room, none of the lobby had any idea what was coming. And as soon as Douglas Carswell walked out, walked through that door and sat down next to Nigel Farage, it was a real jaws to the floor moment. It was a real shock for us. I know the Conservative Party itself, the CCHQ, was completely blindsided, as was Number 10. And it was, as you said in the introduction, it really did feel like quite a seismic event. It was a remarkable thing to see happen.
Yeah, I mean, do you think, just as an aside here, do you think that only Carswell and Farage knew? Do you think they kept it that tight?
Yes, yeah. I mean, I'm sure Mrs. Carswell probably knew, but beyond that, no one seemed to know. Apparently, Paul Sykes didn't know. Stuart Wheeler didn't know. So, yeah, I think a lot of that goes back to the much more messy experience they had when UKIP briefly acquired its first MP before the last election, Dr. Bob Spink.
Yeah.
And that was something that he told Number 10 first, and there was a whole debate, a really, really messy, inconclusive debate about whether he'd been sacked from the Tory party or whether he'd quit to join UKIP, whether he'd jumped or was pushed, et cetera, et cetera. So I think Farage probably had that somewhat bitter memory in mind and decided to keep it completely under his hat and hopefully avoid the situation. I've got to say it worked.
Yeah, I mean, also, I guess Carswell is a much sharper operator than Spink and would have, you know, had at least one eye on how it was going to be perceived himself as well.
Undoubtedly, yes. And that was something that came up at the press conference. They kind of said, oh, Douglas, have you spoken to the Prime Minister? And he said, well, if I'd spoken to the Prime Minister about it, you would all have known about it before you walked through the door. he's not wrong. They played it extremely well.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, when I said in my introduction that it's a seismic event, I mean, you know, he hasn't even won the by-election yet. But, I mean, looking at the polls, I mean, there was a Servation poll from Mail on Sunday today, which indicates that UKIP have got a 44% lead. They're at 64 points and the Tories are at 20 points. I mean, really, it's all over bar the shouting, isn't it? Douglas Carswell is going to be the first elected UKIP MP, isn't he?
Well, I think it's looking extremely likely. I mean, it still remains to be seen what happens in the campaign. Of course, you can, particularly in by-elections, you can never rule anything in or out. Freak turns of fortune and even more freakish disasters have happened to people of every single party. But yeah, I mean, the simple fact is, I think that the announcement itself has obviously caught people's imagination. Carswell, as an individual, is a very good constituency MP. He campaigns in a way that a lot of other MPs have never even thought about. He's obviously had the last decade to build up his profile and his reputation in the constituency, and I think crucially he's done what people perceive rightly to be an honourable thing, and that is deciding to hold the by-election in the first place. You know, that's something that he's undoubtedly benefiting from. Interestingly, it's something which I suspect may deter other MPs from following the path if they feel they have to go for a by-election as well. But in this particular one, he's obviously riding high.
Yeah, I mean, you're right there. And I think that throws up a lot of questions, because I was thinking that as well. I was not just thinking in terms of MPs that might defect to UKIP, but I was thinking any MP from now on that decides to defect to another party are instantly going to have thrown back at them, well, aren't you going to stand down and have a by-election like Douglas Carswell did? He's set a bit of a precedent here, hasn't he?
Absolutely. I mean, it wouldn't be the first time that Douglas Carswell has managed to kind of single-handedly change the British Constitution, of course.
Yeah, he got rid of the Speaker, didn't he?
He brought down Michael Martin as the Speaker, and to be honest with you, I think a lot of the problems that John Bercow is having at the minute, as much as Carswell's praised him, the precedent was set that actually if the Speaker does not properly live up to expectations, then MPs are now willing to rebel against him, and that's something that he started. So yeah, it would be quite fitting if he was to change the way that that MPs defect as well.
Yeah, I mean, in terms of Carswell himself, I mean, I've only met him once, but he was very personable and very clearly very articulate and intelligent. And I have interviewed him, although it was via a kind of series of emails back and forth, about a book that he wrote with Daniel Hannan, Tory MEP, a few years ago called The Plan, which I'm sure you've read it yourself, Mark. It sets out a number of different ideas, things like direct democracy and open primaries and so on and so forth, and, you know, changes to the National Health Service. So a pretty coherent set of ideas that both of them had kind of put together, and I think some of them have been adopted since. And what certainly came across when I interviewed him was that I mean, he clearly very passionately believes in all the things in the plan and all of these ideas that he has, but also he's very engaged with the digital side of things and digital democracy. I believe that, at least at the time, the plan was the highest had the highest number of kind of publishing on demand prints issues of any book that had been written up to that point. So he'd clearly very, very heavily engaged with that side of things. And I mean, do you lament the fact that you've lost not only an MP, but someone who is that, you know, ahead of the curve when it comes to things like digital engagement and, you know, kind of forward thinking ideas about democracy?
Yeah, I think the thing is, there are various other Conservative or indeed Labour MPs that I'm sure we can all think of where if they were to suddenly announce I'm joining UKIP, people might feel surprised by it, but they wouldn't necessarily feel quite so shocked or quite so struck by it, because it would fit into the broader narrative that UKIP is a party of the past, of stop the world, I want to get offism. Douglas Carswell isn't one of those politicians. He's much more about the future, about digital democracy, about direct democracy, and about new thinking. And that does make it more troubling, as well as a more serious loss of someone who had something potentially really big to contribute to the future of the Conservative Party.
Yeah, and there was a piece by Liam Halligan in The Telegraph today, I don't know if you read it, where he was very, very complimentary about Carswell, not even really that bothered about which party he is in. He just wants to see him return to the Commons because he's a man who speaks his mind, who probably by now could have achieved some sort of office within government, but has chosen not to follow that path and instead has very, very deeply engaged with, you know, what's going on in this country and to do with the economy and so on and so forth, and has written and spoken very eloquently, very clearly about it, you know, in ways that with the economy improving, you get a lot of Tory MPs who, you know, just kind of cheerlead for that and talk about, you know, how good it is what Osborne's done and how terrible it would be if Labour got back in. Well, Carswell isn't like that. He's actually looked into the detail of the structural problems to do with the economy, and he's talked about it. He even refers to, I think, Osbrown economics. He was clearly never going to achieve high office within the Conservative Party. I mean, I don't know whether, who knows what will happen now he's in UKIP, but I mean, people like that are few and far between, aren't they?
Yes, and you know, I think this is why you'll see a lot of Conservatives, not just the MPs, but the party grassroots, having a similar reaction that I've had in the last couple of days, which is one that's much more in sorrow than in anger about this. I think it's a real loss. I wish it could have been avoided. I do believe that if UKIP win this by-election, then it will make an Ed Miliband Downing Street much more likely. That'll make it less easy for us to get an in-out referendum on the EU and do various other forms of harm to the country. But it's a grim situation for a Conservative. It's a grim situation for someone who's a Eurosceptic. It's a grim situation for someone who's on the centre-right, where, you know, potentially, on balance, the best outcome would be someone like Douglas Carswell, of his calibre of thinker, leaving the House of Commons. That is really bad news, and I think it's pretty emblematic of the split on the centre-right and the harm that it's going to do, that you have someone like Douglas and someone like Daniel Hannan, MEP, his best friend, essentially, in different tribes.
Yeah, I mean, I did wonder whether Hannan might eventually follow him, although he did write a piece not long before Carswell defected, actually making it very clear that he has no intention of doing that. So I guess for now they probably are going to remain in different tribes. I was wondering whether the fact that Carswell has decided to defect in this way is an indication that people who think like he does, I mean, he is very clearly Eurosceptic. I mean, I don't know if he's ever explicitly stated that he's a better off outer, but he clearly comes across as someone who is. And it's making me wonder whether a substantial proportion of the better off outers are of the opinion that actually the Conservatives winning the next election is not the best route to getting out of Europe. Because even if the referendum is delivered, and I mean, I personally think that if Cameron is in a majority government or even a minority government after the next election, he, hook or by crook, he will make the referendum happen. I'm not convinced at all by these people who claim, oh, you can't trust Cameron. There is no way. There is absolutely no way politically you can get out of this now, the way it's gone too far. But even if he is able to deliver the referendum, he will go and he will do his negotiation or his renegotiation, and he will come back and he will do what all prime ministers do, which is claim a victory for whatever renegotiation he wanted, and then campaign to stay in. And if you have a referendum where the three main political parties, Conservatives, Labour and Lib Dem, well, I say main, but, you know, the main parties as they stand at the moment in the House of Commons, are all campaigning to stay in, then that referendum, from the perspective of better off outers, will probably be lost. Therefore, a better option is to build up UKIP's parliamentary presence and wait for a better opportunity, and also an opportunity where perhaps Cameron has lost office and resigns and is replaced by a much more Eurosceptic leader of the Conservative Party. And then you could actually have UKIP with a parliamentary presence and the Conservative Party, probably not in government, but, you know, leading the opposition in Parliament, actually campaigning to come out of Europe. And that would be a much better opportunity then to convince the electorate to vote to come out of Europe in a referendum.
Yeah, I think it's certainly a school of thought within some kind of branches of Euroscepticism that a referendum is something to be more wary of than to rush towards. I think there are, actually, particularly among people who have a memory of the previous referendum on Europe, tend to be more concerned about this, I find. With regard to the balance of opinion within the Better Off Out campaign, I mean, I actually first met Douglas because I launched the Better Off Out campaign. So he was one of the first MPs who we sat down with after the 2005 general election, along with Philip Davis and various others, to talk about this. And I'm not convinced by any means that the Better Off Out kind of group within the Conservative Party are anywhere near a majority thinking that actually you need to strengthen UKIP to make this happen. Broadly, I think they we've heard from some of them in the last few days that they believe that this referendum is the best way to make it happen. And of course, the simple fact is that I don't think any of us feel we can afford another 5 years of EU integration, or for that matter, another 5 years with Ed Balls back at the helm in the Treasury, on more general terms. The thing that really struck me about Douglas Carswell's motivations during his speech on Thursday was that it was actually much less about the EU than it was about other things. He did provide a list of his reasons, things that bit by bit, you know, drip by drip, had persuaded him that he wanted to defect to UKIP. And the EU referendum was only one of them. Also in there were things like the power of recall, Zach Goldsmith's bill being rebuffed, was something he mentioned several times. A broader feeling about the way the structure of the state in the UK, the management of the deficit, accountability, the ability to hold or force referenda on wider issues, holding open primaries, internal party democracy. And actually, I think really this goes to the heart of the way Douglas Carswell thinks about the world. For him, unlike some other Eurosceptics, the EU is not the be-all and end-all issue. For him, it's a symptom of a much broader worldview. He's an iconoclast at heart in that kind of great roundhead tradition that obviously flourished in Essex and various other places in the 17th century, and he would describe himself in that way. And what he really wants to see is a breaking down and then a building up again, or a reconstruction of how we govern ourselves. Now, once you start to think like that, that means that, yes, leaving the EU is one element of it, but all sorts of other things that were put across in the plan that he wrote with Dan Hannan in his own book, The End of Democracy, all sorts of other things need to happen too. And actually, I think the thing that really appealed to him wasn't necessarily UKIP or get us out of the EU. I think it was much more that wider opportunity to really shake the foundations of Westminster, so he hopes. And that's an important element of this, because it's certainly the case that there is a home in the Conservative Party for people like me, for people like Douglas, who are like Dan Hannan, for all sorts of other people who want to leave the EU. And I think there's a realistic chance that we can make it happen. So I'm not convinced that was his main motivation.
I mean, in some ways, I think, as we both alluded to, Douglas Carswell is very much a one-off. And so therefore, it's difficult to extrapolate from this. I mean, I suppose the first question following on from that would be, do you think that between now and the general election there will be any more defections from the Tory party to UKIP? But I mean, I guess it's difficult to answer that, because if I'd asked you 4 days ago, do you think Douglas Carswell was going to defect, I'm sure you'd have said no, and you'd have genuinely thought no. But given what we now know, do you think it is likely in the next 9 or so months we'll see any more?
I'm pretty convinced there are one or two individuals who are considering it, who've probably been considering it for a while, and are still going to be thinking about it. But the crucial thing here is that Carswell had the courage of his convictions and called this by-election. So yeah. I think that drastically reduces the chances, because people will be thinking, you know, I wouldn't have the novelty value of being the first. Not many people have such naturally UKIP flirting territory as Clacton, which I know that Matthew Goodwin and others have been looking at the numbers on this and reckon it's one of the most UKIP favourable seats in the entire country, yeah. Which I think does drastically reduce the chances. You can never rule it out. And, you know, for Carswell, as I've just said, it's about a complex mix of ideological and practical and kind of philosophical questions. For others, you know, there's always people who have an animus against the Prime Minister. There's some who may fall out with their local parties and fear they might be deselected. There's all sorts of things that could suddenly tip someone over the edge. So the interesting thing is that Carswell's announcement makes this more real, more practical as a possibility, but at the same time it makes it a more difficult hurdle to successfully get over and survive.
Yeah, I mean, there are potentially other dynamics at play here as well, though. For example, if UKIP have an MP, an elected MP at that, and a recently elected MP, doesn't that make it more likely that Nigel Farage will feature at least in some way in any leadership debates running up to the next general election?
Yes, it does. And, you know, I think probably the government's best defence against this, or David Cameron's best defence against this, is the decision of Clegg and Farage to agree to debate each other in what was basically a B-team or second division debate in the run-up to the European elections. And, you know, if I was the Prime Minister, I'd be thinking my backup plan is to say, OK, we'll have a serious debate for the two men who might be Prime Minister, Ed Miliband, David Cameron, and we'll have a B-team, a kind of minnows debate for you know, the Lib Dems and UKIP and, yeah, maybe even the Greens, who knows. And, you know, that would be a fallback position, I think. I mean, there's short-term good news here for UKIP. You know, they've got a huge amount of publicity. Their campaign, which was really drifting after the Newark by-election, after they'd lost a lot of their key staff members, had got elected to Brussels or become members of staff of the new MEPs in Brussels, they were a bit of a ghost ship over the summer. And I know, from having spoken to some of them, that senior people within the UKIP machine, the UKIP party organisation, were quite worried about what was going to happen next. How do they get back onto the front foot? So, you know, the luck of the devil has kind of shone on Nigel Farage yet again and kind of saved him at the last minute. The question is what happens in the medium or longer term. You know, he's not a man known for particularly liking having other people in his party treated like celebrities. He's not a man who's known to like other people, being on the media's doorstep, which of course Douglas Carswell now is, whereas Farage will be away in Brussels or out and about campaigning or in pubs and stuff. I'm not sure that's all going to sit very well with Farage personally. And at the same time, you know, Carswell, is, as we've seen, is very much his own man. He knows his own mind. And he has a lot of opinions that differ from UKIP's official policies and from the stuff that seems like it's going to come out in their manifesto. So, you know, we may have a bit of a hail the conquering hero thing for a few months, but I'd be a little bit concerned about the internal friction that could build up there.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a fair point. And yeah, I mean, you know, Farage, UKIP has largely been seen in the last few years as a one-man band, and basically whatever Farage says goes. And I think you're right, you know, once you start to get more significant players and if you do get any more defections or you know, if other UKIP senior members really start to build up their profile, you know, people like Paul Nuttall, for example, and Diane James, then Farage probably won't like that. But if UKIP is to mature into what I would describe as a proper political party, it has to get over those growing pains. It can't be a personality cult focused around one person. So in a way, although it might be painful for Farage personally, for the party itself, having big hitters like Carswell would probably be a good thing, I guess, in some respects. But the other thing I was going to ask is that if UKIP have an elected MP, and actually, I mean, okay, let's not count our chickens yet, but it could be an MP elected with quite a significant majority, then isn't that going to encourage other voters in other constituencies where they're thinking, well, I might vote UKIP, but actually they've got no chance, so I'll stick, you know, I'll cling to Nurse for fear of something worse, you know, I'll stick with voting Tory because I don't want to risk letting Ed Miliband in. Won't a lot of waverers be emboldened to actually vote UKIP, and couldn't that start some kind of domino effect where UKIP actually do end up getting a number of MPs at the next general election, or even if they don't get that many MPs, they're in a very, very strong second place to then, you know, do very well at any subsequent election. And a little bit in the way that, you know, the Lib Dems have built up over subsequent general election cycles.
Certainly. And, you know, that's the nightmare scenario for David Cameron and the Conservative Party. You know, UKIP's biggest enemy for the last 21 years since they were founded, since they, you know, they first emerged as a very small pressure group, has always been the, well, you know, you might be right, I might like you personally, you might be a good speech, might be a good leaflet, might be a good manifesto, but you're never getting in, it's a wasted vote. And that's something which, you know, all political parties face in one part of the country or another, or one seat or one circumstance or another. But it's something that, as a new party, that's been their biggest challenge. And I think the big breakthrough moment for UKIP in the last couple of years was that run of by-elections where they kept coming in second. It was the places where they kept, you know, in Rotherham, for example, as well as in Eastleigh, in Sale, all these places where suddenly it seemed like actually they could talk about themselves as a kind of official opposition, places in particular where the Conservative Party is completely withered. But that has already started getting people thinking, tell you what, maybe my vote isn't wasted. And once there's an actual MP who's won an election, they've got living proof. They can put them on a platform, they can put them on TV, they can wave them around and demonstrate that that's the case. And, of course, in a lot of places, UKIP, the vast majority of places, UKIP aren't serious contenders to win the parliamentary seat, but they are enough to prevent a Conservative candidate winning, or they are enough to unseat a sitting Conservative MP. And that's a serious concern for the Conservative Party for obvious reasons. You know, even last time round, you know, to take a very crude measure of it, if you were to take the UKIP vote and look and see whether that vote in total was larger than the difference between defeat and victory, UKIP, you know, there were 27 seats where Tories lost. But if they'd managed to get all of the UKIP votes, obviously a fantasy situation, if we managed to get all of it, we could have won the seat. Now, things are more complex than that, but I suspect we will see, you know, if this bandwagon keeps on rolling like this, I suspect we will see quite large numbers of seats where the Conservatives had reasonable chances of winning, or where we have incumbent MPs at the moment, where Lib Dems or the Labour Party could end up getting in because of a strong UKIP performance. And that is disastrous. We saw what happened in Canada in the 1990s. We saw how long it took them to work out an agreement to reunite the right in that country, which has since proved very successful. But you know, this happened to the left in the 1980s. We should remember what a good time the Conservatives had as a result of that split on the left, and just imagine how much Ed Miliband's going to enjoy it if it happens to us.
You've stolen my final question, which was going to be that about, you know, the reflection of what we saw happen to the left in the 80s and early 90s, and how long it took them. It took them 18 years of opposition to rebuild into any sort of coherent political force that had a shot at winning elections. I mean, do you think we are starting to witness a realignment of the right? That will be my final question.
I think I certainly don't think this is a flash in the pan. I think this is something that the right is already split. We can already see it hurting in various different places, hurting the small C conservative movement in various different ways in various different elections. That hurt is going to grow, and I've got to say, particularly the antipathy towards conservatives with a capital C, the antipathy towards David Cameron in particular, among the movers and shakers in UKIP, not necessarily all of their voters, but certainly among the kind of core group who kept this party running for a long time and who now lead it, is going to make it extremely difficult to get that reconciliation to happen. It's something where, you know, we see this all the time in politics, where people will hate someone who's close to their position, but not as pure as them, much more than they hate their actual opponents. And, you know, I've had conversations with, you know, like most Conservatives, I know quite a few former Tories who are now in UKIP. I know a lot of them who are pretty sad about the situation. I know others who will happily tell you, I hate Cameron more than I hate Brussels.
it's the old Judean People's Front, the People's Front of Judea syndrome, isn't it?
Absolutely, yes. And, you know, this is something that you normally hear among kind of Trotskyists, I think, traditionally. And, you know, that is something that is going to benefit the left for several years to come. I think it's very hard to see how you can put the genie back in the bottle. And this is not something that happened overnight. This is, you know, certainly the self-inflicted part of this from the Conservative Party's point of view took years or decades to do to ourselves. It took a very long time to do this much damage. It took a very long time to alienate a sufficient number of people in this way. And it's going to take an extremely long time to heal this division. We need to change our attitudes. And I've been quite encouraged to see, for example, we called on Thursday for people not to try and do the stereotypical old thing of slinging mud at a turncoat and talking about who owns a seat and so on, being horrible to Douglas Carswell. Partially because it would have been wrong, it would have been untrue, but also because it's simply the worst way to go about things. It would have driven an even deeper wedge between people who ought to be kind of brothers and sisters in a movement where we have an awful lot more in common than we have that divides us. I'm glad to see that most people have kind of taken that line as well. But, you know, it's a very small first step, potentially, on a very long road to reuniting the right in the UK.
Mark Wallace from Conservative Home, thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you.